Okay, let's talk a little bit about who Reb Chaim Volozhin was, what his role was in the late 18th century, and then we'll get a sense of understanding the Sefer. Okay, let's first start with his biography. Then we'll take a step back, a little short sketch of his biography. Then we'll take a step back, and we'll think about what's going on in the Jewish world in the latter half of the 18th century, and then why he's such an important figure, and then why this book is such an important part of his life and of today's Torah world. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. Reb Chaim Volozhin is born in 1749, and probably the most important thing I can say is that in those days, there was no such thing as a yeshiva. Yeshiva were local batei medrash supported by the kehillah, which means there were 10, 12, maybe 15, maybe maximum a little more people that sat and learned with a local rabbi. It was part of the local rabbi's job. And the kehillah supported them, gave them some food to eat, gave them a place to sleep, nothing really major, no dormitories, no big schedules, no one gathered in yeshivas. And then if you were super brilliant, then you superseded the local rav, and you went to the next town, and you moved to the bigger town where there was a bigger rav, and so on, and then you're a little more tower, and you went with him. But the notion of yeshivas wasn't very well established. Okay, so he's born in 1749. He goes through that, I wouldn't call it the yeshiva system. It wasn't really yeshiva. It was a local base matter structure of how you learned Torah. Remember, those days, there was no education. People didn't go to high school. People didn't have jobs. They weren't allowed to have jobs. So with a rare exception, you learned 10, 15 years, and then you went out and tried to, you know, earn your living. Okay, now, 1768, he moves to Vilna. So he's about more or less 20 years old. And, of course, the Vilna Gaon was born in the early part of the 18th century. And here's someone that, you know, came from nowhere. The stories they tell about the Vilna Gaon, someone that knew Shastin, who's 3 years old, things are just beyond our imagination. So there's this mythical, almost supernatural angel that Hashem gifted us into the Torah world, whose knowledge and whose level of learning, he slept 2 hours a night. There's someone from like a different planet, from a different world. And Reb Chaim Volozhin goes and spends only 8 years with him. So he arrives in Vilna in 1768, and then already in 1776, he moves to Volozhin near Vilna. This is all in the Pale of Settlement in White Russia, and he becomes the Rav of Volozhin, and that's why his name is called Reb Chaim Volozhin. Volozhin is one of the small shtetlach in that area, so his name is Reb Chaim Volozhin because of the town he is from, the Volozhin of Rav. Now, for those years, even though he's distant from the Rav, he only learned by the Vilna Gaon for 8 years, he still is one of the only people who's granted access to the Vilna Gaon. So he comes back from Volozhin to visit the Gaon in Vilna. The Gaon is in seclusion. He's learning all day. He doesn't really want to waste the time. Famous stories. His sister comes to visit him. His butler doesn't say hello to her. Well, you know, Vilna Gaon, evidently on his deathbed, was shaking and shivering. Why? Because he remembers 20 years before he died, he had been Mevatel Torah. I don't remember how the story goes, for 20 minutes or 20 seconds. That was the only time in his life he wasn't learning Torah. So the Vilna Gaon is, again, this mythical figure beyond human proportion. Doesn't really speak to people that much. Secludes, goes in gullus, goes out of town to try to, you know, to build humility or to build to move away from society. And Chaim Volozhin has these meetings with him. So he receives a lot of the Gaon's traditions. Okay? So the Gaon is Nifter in 1797. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important if you're a Lubavitch, because that's when the Rebbe was in prison, right after the Gaon was Nifter, because the Gaon was Nifter on Chol HaMoed Sukkos, and the entire town of Vilna was thrown into mourning. The Gaon was Nifter. And the Lubavitch and Hasidim, you know, weren't strong opponents of the Vilna Gaon, even though the Gaon was very, very acerbic and venomous against Hasidus. But it was Yom Tov, so they were keeping on their Yom Tov traditions. They were having a Yom Tov Suda and a Yom Tov party, as opposed to the rest of the city that essentially halted Sukkot and was mourning the death of the Vilna Gaon. But it looked like the Hasidim of the Rebbe were celebrating the death of the Vilna Gaon, and that's what riled the Tamidim of the Vilna Gaon and led to the Rebbe's imprisonment, of course, a few weeks after Hanukkah, those 50 days, 53 days between, I think it was Chol HaMoed Hanukkah and Yotes Kislev, when the Rebbe was liberated. But why it's important for non-Hasidim, if you're not following the Rebbe's imprisonment and incarceration, is because in 1802, so it's about 5 years later, the Volozhin Yeshiva is open. So this is essentially the first big major yeshiva. What do I mean by the first big major yeshiva? It has a dormitory, again, not your dorms, not basketball courts, not sweatshirts and programs and buses, but at least a place to sleep and organize food. And it gathers and draws Talmidim from all over Europe. And this is right around the time, it's still a couple years before, but it's right around the time that transportation is improving. You still don't have railroad that prevalent in Europe, but you're starting to have the ability to come and go and to travel better. So it's more, it's reflective of contemporary changes in European society that now travel is getting a little bit easier. Again, still a little bit before. And again, just people make this mistake. The yeshiva movement didn't really take off, I would say, till the maximum, the latter half of the 19th century. You don't really have too many yeshivas that open up. If you're, let's say, in 1850 and you're in Europe, what do you do? Is you go to the local Beis Medrash, you go to the local Rav. Meir started around 1818, I think, but the real explosion of the yeshiva world happens in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900. This is the first yeshiva. It's called the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, and it is the granddaddy of all yeshivas. It's the granddaddy of all yeshivas for two reasons. First of all, structurally, because it's the first yeshiva, and every yeshiva in the world is basically modeled after the Vlashan yeshiva. And second of all, more than just an institutional structure that becomes copied and copied and adapted and modified. And let me just take a moment to tell you, there's a bit of a polemic, but it's an important polemic. In your world, in our world, unfortunately, it's your casualties of unintended consequences. Namely, the Haredi culture, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing, I'm just describing it, announces that it is a continuation of the yeshiva world. And because they dress similar, and because they haven't made changes to the yeshiva world, people in our world sometimes feel that we're not a continuation of the yeshiva world, because they all wore black hats, and they all had beards, and they weren't Zionists. And the answer is, everyone had a black hat in 1880, and everyone had a beard. It was a very colorful world, and some people had broader visions, some people had less broader visions. Zionism is very different than. Zionism is associated with secularism, and people wanted to walk away from religion, not to try to merge religion with Zionism. And of course, World War II and the Holocaust is a total game changer. So when I talk about those great personalities and those great yeshivos of the 1890s and the 1900s and the pre-war period, I think a lot of people in our community have a hard time identifying with them, because when you look at these pictures, they dress differently, and because we've adapted to the modern world, and because we're pro-Zionists, yes, and because of the Haredim, in their culture, they've tried to be exact, precise preservationists of the messages of 1920, which they feel, legitimately or not, can be just clipped and pasted into 2024. So I'm not here, my interest is not Haredi right or wrong. That's not my issue here. I just want you to identify with that world a little more deeply than I think you do. I sometimes chuckle to myself when I walk into a sukkah, and the only rabbanim that people can put up on their walls is Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Amital, Rav Kook, and Rav Soloveitchik. As if those are the only people that they can identify with, rather than with identifying with great, great Talmidei Chachamim who had opinions 70 years ago, or 90 years ago, before the Holocaust and the State of Israel came into being. And those opinions may not exactly be your opinions 100 years later, but you know what? Things change, and who knows what they would say if they walked into the world today. And not about whether their opinions would change or not, it's about your ability to identify with these people and to identify with the yeshiva movement. So when I say the yeshiva movement, I mean us. Even though today, you may not come from that community that some people call yeshivas. Okay, that's fine. You do part of the community. You're not part of the community. I'm not discussing right now how much you are or aren't part of it. But even if you're not, you have to see yourself as the inheritors and the successors of that movement. Because this yeshiva has a lot of Elazina DNA in it. This yeshiva has a lot of Brisker DNA. This yeshiva has DNA from Amir. This yeshiva has DNA from Panovich. I today go to Panovich, doesn't feel very similar to Gush. That's because after World War II and after the State of Israel, some people took a different turn ideologically, and that's where some of these divisions started to surface. Okay? Now, what's the second major accomplishment of Rav Chaim Volozhin in his life? I would say three things would define his life. Number one, Star Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. Number two, he creates this yeshiva movement and this energy for Talmud Torah, which, as you'll see in the Sefer, he feels had been diminished a little bit by certain factors. Number three, of course, is his landmark Sefer, the Nefesh HaChaim, which doesn't get printed in his lifetime. And why doesn't it get printed in his lifetime? Partially it's because, we don't really know, but partially it's because it was very hard to print Svarim in White Russia, because there was a lot of censorship. So it was just very hard to get your Sefer printed. It was very expensive to get the Sefer printed. Second of all, in 1815, there was a famous, infamous fire in Volozhin. Remember, the entire town is wood. So once one building sets fire, the whole town gets ablaze. It was a very, very traumatic experience. People talk about the famous fire in 1815, what it signified, what were the larger messages that people took from that fire. But anyway, a lot of Reb Chaim's works were incinerated in that fire. In 1821, he dies. And on his deathbed, he gives the Sefer to his son, and he asks his son to publish it. In 1824, 3 years after Reb Chaim Volozhiner dies, the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim is first printed. So that's just a little time capsule of Reb Chaim Volozhiner's life. Again, 1749 to 1824. 1824 is Nifter, and then 1821 is Nifter, 1824, the Sefer is published. And in this Sefer, he does two things. First of all, the Sefer is very, very deeply Kabbalistic. Remember, the Vilna Gaon leads to a renaissance of Kabbalah. When I mean a renaissance of Kabbalah, the age of Kabbalah is the early to mid, let's call the entire 16th century, especially fueled by the tragedy of Spain. So whenever Jews experience a tragedy, there's a tilt towards messianic thought, Kabbalistic thought, cosmic thought, something larger is happening, a part of a larger picture. Of course, the middle of the 17th century, so now the 16th century, there's a revival of Kabbalah, led by the Ari HaKadosh, the Arizal HaKadosh in Tzfat, and that creates a lot of ferment, a lot of expectation, a lot of messianism. Then in the middle of the 17th century, it comes to a screeching halt, not really a halt, but it creates a tragic consequence with Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi announces himself as Mashiach, leads to a lot of terrible, terrible, not just that he ended up being a fraud and a sham and converting to Islam and dashing people's hopes and forcing people to sell a full of their property and probably close to a third to a half of the Jewish people believed him and moved to Palestine and their lives were ruined or disheveled, but it led to major, major, major infighting amongst the Jewish communities. Cities, communities were torn apart. Those who supported the Shabtai Tzvi, those who didn't support the Shabtai Tzvi. It was the major, major fracture of the Jewish community of the 17th century. And what happened was, after Shabtai Tzvi and a spiritual descendant of his, I've heard of Jacob Frank. Jacob Frank was another Kabbalistic imposter, in many ways much worse than Shabtai Tzvi because he was aggressive against the Jewish community. He was trying to pull back a little bit from Kabbalah. This is a little bit too hot, too dangerous, too incinerating. Let's just focus on learning, on halacha questions, not to say that the 18th century didn't have its fair share of scandals, but they weren't based primarily on Kabbalah, except for the famous disagreement between Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. That was a famous Rabbi Yaakov Emden thought that Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz was this Beitianist. But people are pulling back a little, but not the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon maintains the study of Kabbalah, much less focused on the Arizal HaKadosh's Kabbalah, but still he popularizes and maintains the importance of studying Kabbalah. And Reb Chaim's Talmud is very much in that image. And this Sefer is a Sefer of Kabbalah. Okay, there are four sections to it. Shar Aleph, Shar Beis, Shar Gimel, and what's called the Sefer HaPerakim, which is like a summary of the first three. The first Shar talks about man's relationship with the cosmos. Very, very Kabbalistic. The second part and the third part talks about our impact of Tefillah on upper worlds. The fourth section, which is called Sefer HaPerakim, is more or less a summary. And the fifth section, which is called Shar Dalad, because the fourth section was called Sefer HaPerakim, so the fifth section, which is called Shar Dalad, 34 sections about the primacy of Torah. That's the section that every yeshiva boy in the world studies. That's the famous Shar HaChaim. I'd probably say amongst the people who study Nefesh HaChaim, imagine 95 or more percent of them haven't opened Shar Aleph, Beis, Gimel, or the fourth section. They all start with Shar Dalad. They're all separate autonomous sections. You can just start Shar Dalad without having read the previous sections. And Shar Dalad talks about the primacy of Talmud Torah. And that probably is the Sefer that's A, most responsible for supercharging Torah learning over the last 200 years, this flowering and flourishing of Torah learning. And certainly in a Haredi community, Haredi culture, where every single element of society is sloped exclusively to Talmud Torah. The only value that's invested in is Talmud Torah. And all of communal assets are directed towards Talmud Torah. And if you're a woman, your responsibility is to raise the kids and support your husband so that he can learn. And it's all sub to Talmud Torah. You'll hear a lot of those echoes in the fourth volume. So what I want from you is one of two things. Either you read the Shar Dal and you say, you know what, I want to be a Haredi. That's great. If that's what suits you and you feel you want to be a Haredi person, I'd be the happiest person in the world. Not like we're right or they're right. They're different ways to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if you feel that's the best way to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you should follow that. Assuming you don't make that change, I want you to be able to hear the importance of Talmud Torah and to use this as a motivator. Well, how committed am I to my own Talmud Torah within the context of my own culture, which maybe balances and calibrates additional elements, not alongside of Talmud Torah, because no value can be held alongside of Talmud Torah, but still recognizes meaningful investments in other value systems, but is my evaluation of Talmud Torah and my investment of Talmud Torah become a little too effaced? So that's why this section, I think if you walk into Meir right now, this is almost like the Tanakh. This becomes, every word here dictates our policy and our culture. Whereas in our world, it should spur you and motivate you to Talmud Torah. Okay, so we serve in the army and we're involved in other areas that we feel are part of our Avodas Hashem, but we still hope to maintain the primacy of Talmud Torah, and sometimes that gets effaced, and sometimes that gets diluted, and this is a good safer to reinforce it. Okay? So that's the general conversation of who Reb Chaim Volozhin is. Now, you can't appreciate Nefesh HaChaim without one additional facet. In the 18th century, Hasidus arises. So Hasidus arises in the early to mid part of the 18th century. It's already gotten a lot of traction by the late 18th century. The Vilna Gaon, of course, is an ardent opponent of Hasidus, very opposed to Hasidus. And part of the Sefer is not just a celebration and a triumph of Talmud Torah, but a polemic against Hasidus. And you'll see the polemic beginning in the very, very onset of the fourth parak, in which he rails against people who are looking for, as we would say, experience in Talmud Torah rather than Talmud Torah itself. Why should you learn Torah? So you should feel spiritually uplifted and close to Hashem and thinking about Hashem? Or you're learning Hashem's Torah, and that is in and of itself being close to Hashem. Even if you're not thinking about your closest to Hashem, you're trying to understand Hashem's das and Hashem's will, and the more of Hashem's will you understand, that's the highest spiritual experience. So we'll talk about it. That's the primary part of the first 5-6 prakim of Shara Dalet, but I just want you to know this isn't written in a vacuum. This is written as an attempt to dispel some of the movements that become popularized because of Hasidus. Okay? So without further ado, let's read a little of the Nefesh HaChaim. I underline, we'll read the first two prakim of Shara Dalet, and you'll see some of this coming about. It's a very poetic language, but not high poetry. You're able to read it, you're able to understand it. So Nefesh HaChaim, Shara Dalet, Perek Aleph. So he writes, in the beginning, I'm here to celebrate Torah, to build interest in Talmud Torah, to give joy to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Line number 5, Asher ze yamim rabim liYisrael, shahushpal isek haTorah haKedosha b'chol dor. I'm just going to read the underlined parts. Again, part of what's happening in the 18th century, which Hasidus is a response to, people aren't learning that much, the communities are in disarray. A lot of the internal infrastructure of Jewish communities is starting to fall apart. There's something called the Vad Arba Aratzos, which had granted Jewish communities in Congress Poland. This is Poland before Poland fell. Poland falls in the latter part of the 18th century, gets gobbled up by Russia, Austria-Hungary, Bavaria. So by the year 1800, there was no Poland. Poland gets gobbled up, and then modern Poland is cobbled together after World War I. So Congress Poland refers to Poland in its heyday, the glorious days of Poland, which ends abruptly in the 18th century. So Jews who lived in the Polish Empire, the Polish kingdoms, had some degree of autonomy. And they were called the Vad Arba Aratzos, four different provinces. They elected officials, they were able to tax, they were able to control. This was all eliminated by the 1750s, 1760s, no longer Vad Arba Aratzos. So the communities are in disarray, they don't have that much money, they're falling apart internally. And you're starting to see Torah learning suffer. People, only the elite get to come to the yeshivos of these local communities. And Hasidus is a response to that. Hasidus is a response, let's try to democratize Avodas Hashem. It's not just about Talmud Torah, it's about other areas of Avodas Hashem. Even if you're a simple butcher, as long as you have the right kavana, you can be an Avodas Hashem. You can be the mikvah cleaner, you can be the businessman, you can be the donkey rider, you can be the donkey. Hashem's everywhere. So once Hashem is everywhere, all it is trying to find Hashem in everything, and you blur the differences between learning a Blad Gemara and cleaning the mikvah, or cleaning the shower, or cleaning the house, because Hashem is everywhere. You just have to eliminate the barrier between yourself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Another response to the decline of Talmud Torah in the 18th century is the Chaim Volozhin. Let's try to, once again, emphasize and stress the centrality of Talmud Torah. So that's what he's bemoaning. Okay, now why is it happening? Kasher einenu haros, this is line number 8, Ata, Barabbas ben Amenu, many of our people, the next underline, Migodel Sevel Masa Ola Parnasa Hashem Yirachem. Just it's so hard to earn a living. People didn't have enough money. So because they weren't able to earn a living, they're not able to sit and learn. Vigam, now he starts to get into his polemic, Kama Me'osan Asher Kirvasa Lukim Yachpatzon, even those who do want to be close to Hashem, Hema Bacharu Li'atzmam Likboa Kol Ikar Limudam Besifre Yira Umusar Kolayamim. What are people spending their time learning? Sifrei Musar, Sifrei Machshava, Yirat Shamayim, to become a better person. He says in the end of the next line, Hashem yislach lahem. Hashem should forgive them. Ki kavanasam l'shamayim. They intend properly. Aval lo zu haderech. This isn't the goal. Now he zooms out and says, let me tell you what happened historically. Next line. Ki daras harishonim hayu kivuim kol yemen be'esek v'higayon tara kedosha. Early generations, the Ramban, let's go back to the Ramban, all they did all day was learn Torah. Bava Metzia, Gittin, Ksuvos, Kachim, whatever they learned. But Allah Hamidrashas, do you know what Gimel Peitaf means? Big Gimel Peitaf? Gimel Peitaf is an acronym, a very important acronym for Gemara, Perish Rashi, and Tassus. And we say Gemara Rashi Tassus. Gimel Peitaf. Before the Rishon, everyone just learned Gimel Peitaf. Gemara Perish Rashi and Tassus. Mishal Heves Avas Torah Sakdosha, they loved Torah, Hayab Baribalibam, it burnt in their heart, there was a passion. That Avas Hashem and Yuras Hashem, they just wanted to learn Torah. Everything was, as we would say, peachy, everything was wonderful. Hine, next underline, Kain Darko Shel HaYetzer, but the Yitzhar is always updating his tricks, always updating his methods. Liskane B'am Hashem Eli, he's always jealous of our religious success. So the next line, Lahatil B'am Eres, so he wants to poison us. So what did he do? People started learning. I'm just going to paraphrase. And somehow the learning was no longer spiritually impactful. They were great learners. They were great intellectuals. They knew the learning. But it didn't trickle down to there. Right? This, of course, is the great, great, great concern of Musar. The Musar movement is just starting when Reb Chaim Volozhin dies. So he's not that aware of the Musar movement. He's more directed towards Hasidus. Let's generally, Hasidus starts 1720, early 18th century, Musar's early 19th century, late 18th century. So this was the Musar concern, that in earlier generations it was enough just to sit and learn Gemara Rashi Tassos, because that was enough to lead to spiritual renaissance and spiritual development. But now we need to frontally learn Musar Svarim. So Reb Chaim is describing the phenomena of people trying to learn Musar Svarim, but he's not aware of the Musar movement. He's not really accrediting it. But for him, it's something which is reflected by the Hasidic movement. Okay? So they started to learn, instead of just learning Gemara Rashi Tosfos. So what happened? Lizos, the next underline, his aruatzmam kama migdolem ein ha'idah. So many people realized this problem. People were learning Gemara Rashi Tosfos, and they weren't developing morally and spiritually. Next underline, umalo esiyatam lavo betochachos b'musarim uv'midos. So they started to write svarim about tochacha, we call that musar, midos, musar, v'chibru sefer ayira, they wrote svarim about yirashamayim, liosam oskim betar kidosho v'avada b'yiras Hashem tahara. So they said, you know what, don't learn Torah all day. Spend a little bit of time learning musar to make sure that you frontally address what we call religious and moral growth. Okay, make sure that you still learn Torah, fundamental substance of Torah, but learn a little musar just to make sure you're developing properly. What happened? The next paragraph, Bidaras halalu bavon, sein harab nafachu. Everything became inverted. Hagavoa bashpel. The higher tiers of learning became low. Shekama v'kama, so many people, some who call it kukvias limudam, their entire focus of learning, rov hayamin, rak b'sifra hiyir v'musar. Be'amram, kizek al adam ba'olam, olasak b'hem tamid. Kihema malhivim alavavos, it makes our hearts excited and passionate, and it makes us humble, and has us good midos. Line number four, v'keter tara, but tara itself, munach b'kerin's office, just lying in a corner, no one's learning tara, they're just learning midos and musar all day. Now here's an interesting story. Uve'enai, part that I parenthesize, it's not a parenthesis, it's a bracket, says, I came to a city, he says, and I went to the local base manager, Chaim Volozhin says, and I didn't even find one shas. I found hundreds of Musar Svarim, but I didn't find one shas. Uve'enai, ra'isi, b'pelach echad, shekokach ispashet eslam zos, ad sheberov, batem midrashim, ein bohem rak sifrei Musar larov. Afilu shas echad shalem, ein bo. Now, in the defense of that city, the reason that Sifrei Musar and not entire Shas is printing a Shas was hugely expensive. Printing a small little 20-page Musar Sefer, you know, you could just print it really quickly. Printing an entire Shas was very expensive. In fact, most cities didn't have a big Shas, except for the big cities. They didn't have an entire Shas. That's why you'll find people whose nickname was Dov Ksivis. Mordechai Kedushin. Why would your nickname be Mordechai Kedushin? Because it was your responsibility to learn Kedushin by heart. And you'd be the go-to guy for Kiddusha. So the Rebbe would need to know, where is that Gemara Kiddusha? He said, call Mordechai Kiddusha over. And Mordechai Kedisha would say, oh, it's a Kedisha Daf Mem Gimel or something. That's what the Gemara says to the Tosfos. He says, he really got a sign, Mesechtes. He just didn't have Shasim. Today, Baruch Hashem, we have Shasim, we have Harilah, we have everything digitized, we have Sefaria, but they didn't have. So I'm not so sure that it was because they valued learning Musa so much more than learning Gemara, which is Musa's far more cheap, and affording an entire Shas was not. Anyway, Hein Lazos, the third paragraph on the page, Asur b'milim miuchal, I can't hold myself back, talk about how painful it is to him. Look at the second line. This is a famous line from the Medrash. Oy lanu miyom hatochacha, oy lanu miyom hadin. Woe is to us when we get to Shemayim, what we're going to have to face when we get to Shemayim. We have to give a final accounting for our behavior. Alavon bitulo shel Torah. And we'll have to face the sin of learning Mesilas Yesharim all day. The sin of learning Rav Kook all day. The sin of learning Musar all day. Oilano miyom, it's all bitul Torah, because you're not learning Torah. You're learning ideas about moral development. You're now learning another piece of Gemara, another Tulsas, another Rashi, more information about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And now he's starting to dig down, not into describing the problem socially, but describing the problem intellectually. So now let's look at paragraph number 3, the last underlined section. Here's where he starts to parse the issues. B'choshva, what's the key mistake? Forget what's happening socially, demographically. What's the key mistake? They believe ki'inyan lishma. When we'll see later, Chazal speaking about learning Torah lishma, they think, what does lishma mean? Perish b'dvekas gadol. You're clinging to Hashem, you're thinking about Hashem. Bli hafsek. The gam ra chol yosem is, and worse, a worse sickness is shesovrim bedaita. They believe sheesek atar belodvekas. If he's just learning a dry gemara in above a comma, you're not thinking about Hashem. They think eno klum v'lo toelis, because it's not giving you a spiritual punch or a spiritual drive. He's going to attack that idea, and then he'll redefine what Torah lishma is. Okay, in Parak Beis, he attacks the idea. And he attacks the idea with four proofs. Four proofs that the value doesn't lie in your own spiritual experience in Torah, but in the Torah itself. Okay? Proof number one. I'll tell it to you, each proof, and then we'll read it. This to me is the most audacious proof. There's a Medrash, and the Medrash says that David HaMelech turns to Hashem, and he says, Hashem, I want Tehillim, my Tehillim, to be just as valuable to you as Negoyim and Olas, as the very, very dry and technical halachas of Tzaras, Negoyim, and of Olas, if a mace is found in the same building, and you are, and you're Tami, Tumas Oel. I want Nitalim to be just like Negoyim and Olas. Now, we read that Gemara and say, aha, you see, Tehillim really is like Negoyim and Olas. Rav Chaim Volozhin read the Gemara Medrash in two ways. Number one is, well, you see, the gold standard is Negoyim and Olas. And David HaMelech is begging Hashem, please, please, please take my Tehillim. What could be more spiritually powerful than Tehillim? Especially when held up to the dry technical halachas and the Negoyim and Olas. So David HaMelech is saying, I know it's not as great as learning Mesechus Olas and Mesechus Negoyim, but you know, please, account it also, Hashem. And here he says something amazing. Rav Chaim Volozhin says, you ready? The Medrash doesn't tell us what Hashem answered David. We don't know if Hashem ever said yes. It could be that Hashem told David, what are you wasting your time with Tehillim? You should be learning all this in the Negoyim. Now that's a very harsh way to say. David wasn't punished for writing Tehillim, but maybe it did. Maybe David had to make up for lost time by learning Negoyim and Olas after he wrote Tehillim, because it wasn't as valuable as Negoyim and Olas, because he took some time to write them. Maybe it's a good decision for Am Yisrael, but in his own personal cheshbon and nefesh, he had to make up the time that he had taken away and detracted from the Negoyim and Olas. So if you're looking at the spiritual component and the spiritual strength and the spiritual vibe, of course, when you scream Tehillim, it's much more spiritual and you feel close to Hashem. And Negoyim and Olas is just reading information about Hashem's will. Yeah, the gold standard is Negoyim and Olas. David HaMelech is trying to climb up and equate his Tehillim to Negoyim and Olas. And not only that, but we know if Hashem says yes. Let's read Rechaim V'Leshe, okay? Parak Beis. He says as follows. Sherei Amar Azal, line number 2 B'Medr. Shebikish David HaMelech Alev Hashem L'Fonav Yisbarach. David HaMelech asks Hashem, Sha'osik B'Tehillim Yechashiv Etzla Yisbarach Chilo Oseh B'Negoyim and Olas. To be like Negoyim and Olas. Harei She'isik B'Helichas Hashas B'in V'Yegia Learning a blad Gemara is more valuable to Hashem than saying to him.
V'im nomar shel lishma perish dveikus. If lishma means your own spiritual thinking about Hashem, halo ein lishma dveikus yosin yiftem eres tehillim. Tehillim is much more dveikus. So evidently, what people call dveikus, that's not the goal, because tehillim is the second standard. Line number 6, end of the line, end of the period, v'gam, mi yodea im hiskim HaKadosh Baruch Hu hayad v'sen. We don't know if Hashem agreed to David HaMelech's request. Ki lo matzina b'divrayim tshuva. Hashem didn't give an answer. Now again, I'm going to always try to tell you how this is a radical voice, not necessarily something you should agree with to the full extent, but understand that he's putting some very powerful ideas out there. Yes, we're happy David HaMelech wrote to him, and this is a Medrash, it's not a Gemara, and the Medrash is just trying to maybe hyperbolically stress how important a garment all of a sudden. David HaMelech is not punished for writing Tehillim, and if you decide to write Tehillim, that's a good thing to do, especially since you could be wasting your time with a million other horrible things less than Tehillim. But he is reminding us that you can't just gauge the value of spiritual experience based on how much you're thinking about Hashem, because there's something, as it were, higher than thinking about Hashem, and that is, I'll just give it away, thinking about Hashem in his terms, not your terms. When I'm thinking about Hashem's vagaries, I'm trying to understand my relationship with Hashem. That's always going to be an approximation. If I don't understand or I don't see him, I don't know who he is. When I'm reading his Torah, I'm reading every word of his will, every word of Torah's as well. So I'm reading the Gemara Olos, I'm listening to him speak, as it were. When I'm thinking about Hashem, I'm trying to build an interface between my limited mortal mind and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is always going to be an approximation. So therefore, it's always going to be inferior. I agree with that. Just because it's inferior, though, doesn't mean it's not important. I do a lot of things in my life that are less important than other things, but I still do them because they give me a well-roundedness. But I do believe, if you ask me, pound for pound, what's more important, learning Bava Basra or saying Tehillim? Of course it's learning Bava Basra. It's why we learn Bava Basra, how much more than we say Tehillim here, but I still take off time to say Tehillim as well. But I want you to see how some of the radicalism creates energy and power and commitment. The second source he quotes is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The Gemara talks about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. It's a Gemara in Sukkah that he knew everything. Every Mishnah, every Gemara, every Medrash, every Psak, every Halacha, it's a famous Gemara in the end of the second parak in Sukkah. Now, if Talmud Torah were gauged by the spiritual moment, then wouldn't it be better just to take one piece of Torah and just learn it more deeply and repeat it and try to use it as a portal to think about Hashem, the thing that you're familiar with? Oh, you take this Gemara, how can I feel a Kodesh Baruch Hu in this Gemara that I know inside out? Think about the Gemara you know the best. The Gemara you really, really know well. Your Bar Mitzvah Gemara, the Gemara you passed the test to get accepted to Yeshivat Har, I don't know. The Gemara you really, really know well. So I know the ins and outs. Since I know the ins and outs, I could find spirituality more capably than coming to a new Gemara that I have to cut new ground and work hard. So why are we extolling, oh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he learned new Gemaras and new Mishnahs. You should just pick one piece of learning and repeat that and try to soak it and saturate it for spiritual experience. Evidently, the more of Hashem's will you know, the higher grade you're at. So let's see what he says here. He says, V'gam, this is line number 8. I didn't underline the second part, but it's line number 8 after the period. Ki hayadai le'inyan advekos. If we're just pursuing dveikos, it would be enough, b'mesachas achas, oh, Perek Echad, oh, Mishnah Echad, she also called on the Vekos. If the goal is something beyond Torah, and Torah is just the medium, the portal to get to that goal, so you can standardize the medium. And better to standardize the medium is I'm not trying to learn Torah, I'm trying to learn Torah to get to the Vekos. So let me try to use the tool that I'm most familiar with, right? Just like you, I don't know, you do things out of habit and out of routine that you know how to do because you know it will give you a good experience. So if I'm looking for the experience, just pick one Mishnah, one Gemara, just repeat it again and again and try to leap towards Dekos. Yet he says, V'lo kein matzinu, the beginning of the line, Rabbeinu Zichrona Levracha, Sha'am Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Shilurniach Mikra, Mishnah, Halachos, Agados, he learned everything because he wanted to know as much about HaKadosh Baruch Hu as he could. The third proof he brings is from a Medrash in Mishlei. And essentially the Medrash is you get to Shemayim, you're all excited, I went to Herzog, I know Tanakh well, and Hashem basically screams at you, why don't you know Gemara? And you say, okay, well, I know Gemara really well, Hashem says, why don't you know Taras Konim? Well, I know Taras Konim and Gemara, basically you can't win the Yom HaDin. Again, I don't think Hashem is that mean-spirited, and Hashem is not going to look at you and scream at you. But it's creating an attitude that battles against complacency. Oh, well, I know a little bit of Torah. I remember when you first started Yeshivat Har Zion, you were a top boy in your school, you got 100 on your test, you felt like you were a really big Talmud Chacham, and then you got to Yeshiva and you realize you know nothing.
And you see how large Torah is and how broad Torah is. And to a degree, that's going to happen in Shemayim. When we get to Shemayim, we're going to come up with all of our Torah accomplishments, and Hashem will point out our Torah shortcomings, not in a way to taunt us or to punish us, but a way to highlight the infinity and the enormity of Torah. But again, if Dveikos were the goal, then the final test and the final interview should be surrounding Dveikos. Hashem should take out his Dveikos meter and say, how much Dveikos did you really reach through the Torah you learned, regardless of how broad and sweeping the Torah study that you were engaged in. And yet, I'll just read a little bit of the Medrash with you. The Medrash says as follows, Uvi Mishlei Rabsa, it's the end of the line, Mishlei Rabsa, Perek Yot Amar Bihuda, I think it is, Bor E Kama Kasha Yomadin. How difficult the final accounting is. Shasad HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ladan is Kol Olam Kula. Ba Mishiyesh Biyado Mikra. You really know Tanakh well, Ve'im Biyado Mishnah, you never studied Mishnah, Kadosh Baruch Hu Hofech Haspana Bimenu, Umitzir Gehenim Mizgai Rosh. And turns away from you, Gehenim starts to incinerate you. Okay. Ba Mishiyesh, next line, Shnei Starim. You've learned two full Starim. I know Nashim and Ezekim by heart, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Amolei B'ni, Kol Alachos Lamulo Shanisa. What about Kachim? What about Zroim? What about Taras? You know everything. What about Taras Konim? Etc., etc. By the way, I should have said this earlier, in part, not because of the Sefer, because the Sefer happens after he dies, and Mishiyah happens when he's alive, but because of this idea expressed in the Sefer, two of Reb Chaim Volozhin's major, major shifts in the academic experience of Talmud Torah, I mean academic, not as in college, but in terms of how people study Torah, number one, he moved away from Pilpul. He was very opposed to Pilpul. Now, the irony is that 50 years or 60 years after he moved away from Pilpul, more towards Pshat, there'd be a great man in Reb Chaim Brisk who wouldn't restore Pilpul, but would create a much more methodological approach towards dissecting the logic of Shas, which is very different from Pilpul. The best way I can explain the difference between Pilpul and Reb Chaim's learning, okay, there are, let's say, three types of learning. One type of learning is just, what does it say? Gathering the information, classifying the information, organizing information. That could take you 500 lifetimes. And the other is analysis. Now, Pilpul is essentially as follows. If I say this, and I say this, and I say this, and I say this, then I can say that. If you pull out one of the ifs, the entire structure falls. I call it a house of cards. You pull one card out, the whole system collapses. Lamdas, what we call Brisk or Lamdas, which is so popular today, is like a Lego set. You take a few pieces of Lego, and then you attach it to another few pieces of Lego, another few pieces of Lego. Now let's say one of the attachments is faulty. You don't agree. Okay, take that piece off, you still have the other pieces of Lego attached. It's divisible parts. It's cellular parts, and you put together a sugya, even if you don't feel one part belongs to the other parts, you still, the other parts are still meaningful. You've created atomized components if you try to combine together, but it's not a house of cards. If, then I can say a conclusion. That's the easiest way. Pilpul is very, very unregulated, very uncharted. I once tried to study what Pilpul was. It's a very different way of learning, and Reb Chaim was very opposed to it. The Vilna Gaon was very opposed to it, but then 50 years later. One of the great ironies is that the Vilna Gaon and Reb Chaim Volozhin are responsible for today's Torah world. When I say Torah world, I mean the entire Torah world, because of their energy, their yeshiva, and their sefer. And people feel this is written by Reb Chaim Volozhin, but it's inspired by the Vilna Gaon. The irony is, 80% of the Torah world today does not learn like the Vilna Gaon. 80% of the Torah world today learns like Reb Chaim Brisk. So it's an interesting, I asked Rav Krumbine, who sits right across from me once, we have taken him to a wedding, and he wrote a huge sefer from the Vilna Gaon. I said, was it good for the Vilna Gaon that Reb Chaim switched the style of Torah, or was it bad for the Vilna Gaon? What I mean is as follows. No one learns like the Vilna Gaon anymore. Very few people do. But that just makes the Gaon like even more mythical. Like he's in a different planet. We're not like the Vilna Gaon. We learn a different way. If you want to put it into more contemporary terms, has anyone ever heard about Reb Chaim Kanievsky, who he was? He was the one who was just Nifter. Okay. So obviously one of if not the greatest Talmud Chacham of our generation, he learned like the Vilna Gaon. His style of learning was not very analytical. Again, there's analysis and classification, there's analysis and organization, but it's more encyclopedic, gathering all the information. Now, when I say all the information, I don't just mean Gemara. All the Gemara, all the Rishonim, all the Echronim, but gathering. Okay, if you have time, what do you spend your time on? Reading more and collating more, or reading less and thinking more? It's just a question. You can't do both. His father, the stipler of Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, who wrote a series of sermons called the Kielos Yaakov, he was into Lamdas. Now, I wonder, and I said this to a lot of people, and they agreed with me, in 50 years, right now everyone talks about Chaim Kanievsky because that's the one we knew. Your generation didn't know Yaakov Kanievsky, the Kilos Yaakov, the stipler. But in my mind, it's pretty clear that in 50 years, with the hindsight of history, people will be learning more about more Kilos Yaakovs than they will be learning the Svarim of Chaim Kanievsky. He didn't write Svarim that help you delve deeper into the sugya. He just wrote Svarim then. Some of the Svarim are encyclopedic on errors that no one wrote on, like Zerayim. There's an entire set of Emunah Sitecha on Zerayim, so that's like the only Sefer on Zerayim, the go-to Sefer. But I know for myself, I would never, like how many times I open any of Reb Chaim's Svarim, but I always open a Kilos Yaakov. Whenever there's a Kilos Yaakov by his father, by the stipler, I'll always read it because he really hits the fundamental pillars of the sugya. So it's interesting, the Vilna Gaon style versus Reb Chaim's style very much was manifest in the style of the father and the son. In fact, there's like a legendary story where the stipler, Yaakov Kanievsky, you ready? Was very disappointed in his son, Chaim, because he wasn't being alumni. Because his style of ruling was encyclopedic. And evidently, at some point, I think it was the Chazon Ish, intervened and assured the stipler, don't worry, he'll be all right. Let him learn different. But there's this legendary story that the stipler was a little bit opposed to the son not becoming alumni, because he wanted his son to learn in his style. So this is what you appreciate, the different styles of learning. So there was a movement away from Pilpul, but the biggest change in Volozhin, and in many ways a change that I think has really deeply, deeply influenced this yeshiva as well, it's called the Kol HaTorah Kula program. What had happened was because we lost so many parts of Torah that were no longer halachically relevant, and because we had limited resources, that doesn't mean money, but intellectual resources, the field of Torah study shrunk. And we started focusing on Nashim and Ezekiel, on Kiddushin, Ksivos, Gittin, Bava Kama, Bava Basa, because these were the areas that are most relevant, right? Contracts, damages, marriages, divorces, contracts around marriage, Ksivos. You can start to learn Zvachin, like we don't have Beis Hamikdash. You can start to learn Tumah Vatara, we don't really have relevancy for Tumah Vatara anymore. You can start to learn Zrayim, we're not in Eretz Yisrael. So major, major areas. And it wasn't just areas of Shas that became less attractive, but there was a general contraction. People stopped learning Tanakh, which obviously in this yeshiva, you know that we're trying to recover that tradition. And Torah became very, very shrunken, very deep, but very shrunken. And because of what we just said, that when you get to Shemayim, Shem's going to say, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about that? So in Volozhin, they started to expand the sweep of what was studied and what wasn't studied. And the Netziv, who was the second generation of Volozhin, Naftali Tzvi here to Berlin, the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, he started a daily shir in Volozhin that hadn't been taking place in any yeshiva in a couple hundreds of years. You know what the shir was? It was a shir in Parshas HaShavua. And that became the foundation of his Sefer HaMikdavar. So when you learn the Netziv and you open up the Netziv, he gave shir, he gave shir in Volozhin every day on Parshas. It was like a big revolution, a Parshas shir. Like today in high school, it would be a Parsha shir. No one was learning Parsha because they were learning Gemara all day. Why should you waste your time on learning Parsha Shemini, a couple of Rashis, when you could be learning another Tosos, another Gemara, another Ran? So this stretching wasn't just let's start learning Kachim and Tyrus as opposed to focusing on Hashem and Ezekim. Let's start learning areas of Torah that have been neglected. One area of Torah is Chumash. Another area of Torah is, have you heard of the Shiltos? The Shiltos is a major work by one of the Gaonim, Rabbi Chai Gaon. They've been completely neglected for hundreds, about 1,000 years. And then Siv writes a Sefer on the Shiltos. Something called Medrash Halacha, Mechilta, Sifri, Sifra. So all of a sudden, this expansion into Kol HaTorah Kula. And then Rabbi Soloveitcher comes and starts applying, again, he doesn't learn Volozhin, but he's very deeply influenced by this whole movement. He starts applying Reb Chaim-style learning to areas that Reb Chaim and his Talmidim never studied that much, namely Moed, where the Rev tried to apply the same tools that we use to understand Bava Kama, Bava Metziah, Gittin, Kiddushin, to apply it in Moed. And his uncle, Velvel, started to apply it to Kachin, which Reb Chaim did learn. So all of a sudden, it was a renaissance of study. So anyway, this is the third Raya and the second Shar of Shar Dalet, the second paragraph of Shar Dalet. The third Raya, which we'll end with towards the end, is, and by the way, I don't have to prove anything to you. I'm trying to prove to you that learning Torah content is superior to trying to reach Dveikos with a Kodesh Baruch Hu. He says, look at the end, the fourth line from the bottom. Omistavra nami hachi. It's a svara, second word on the line. Sheikama halachas merubas yesh b'shas. There's so many halachas when you study Shas. Shebeisa sher adam osik bohem. When you're thinking about Shas, you're not thinking about the vapors. You're thinking about animals, and animal excrement, and pits, and horns, and mouth. Like, just think about Right? How often in Shas do you start thinking about what we would call spirituality? It's very technical. You're parsing information. Sometimes information is very, I don't know, it's demeaning Chas v'Shalom, but it's not elegant, spiritually uplifting information. It's just information he's trying to calculate. Okay, Gashmias. You're learning neither. You're talking about women's menstruation. You're learning about dead bodies. You're learning about, I don't know, Shengufa Halachos. Oh, not just when you're discussing information that's not spiritually surpassing, but just logic. When you're talking about Migo or Chazaka or Shtar, what are you thinking about? We're thinking about very, very intricate logic. Believe me when I say this, because I could have said that. Believe me, this is the way to start. There's nothing very deeply spiritual about it in the way we would define spirituality in Vegas. Dinamigo, is he lying? Is he not right, lying? Last line, Ukimat Bilti Afshari, She Etzlo Az Gam Had Vegas Bishlamus Karai. All of a sudden, you're learning Migo, you're starting to think about Vegas, you think about the intricate logic, the internal logic, the information that's necessary. So evidently, if Shas is so elaborate, then that can't be the goal. To reach Vegas. So, Mirtz Hashem, after Pesach, we'll continue to see, well, what is Torah Lishma? And why is it spiritually elevated to what we would call Devekos? What is this point? I mean, you know, you convinced me, but you know, maybe you could counter and say, you know, maybe it is more important to read Tehillim all day. Maybe you should read Mesillas Yesharim all day. Maybe you should learn parts of the Gemara that lead to direct human-based spirituality. I'll define it in a way, and hopefully you'll hear some of the DNA of this yeshiva coming through. Yes, we believe in everything written in the Sefer. Do we apply it as radically? I'm not so sure. We have a much more calibrated system. We learn Tanakh, we learn Machshava, we learn, but in the end, yes. Why do we learn 10 hours a day of Gemara or whatever, 8-9 hours a day of Gemara? At some point, you have to answer that question. And to say it differently, if when you leave this yeshiva, you're not capable of learning Gemara, your Torah life will be impoverished. There's a fundamental difference between people that learn Gemara and people that don't learn Gemara. And for all the diversity, and for all the fact that we want you to learn whatever excites you, it is our dream and our wish that every single person that leaves Yeshiva Har Etzion has a healthy part of Gemara in their diet, in their menu. Everyone has different menus, different calibrations. But if you're not able to make sense, I don't mean make sense logically, but justify to yourself existentially why it's important to learn Gemara, and to pursue that, you're going to have a very, very inferior life of Talmud Torah. And once your Talmud Torah is not superior, your Avodas Hashem becomes hollower. So our goal is that you should have a healthy relationship with Gemara, and hopefully this Sefer can help you understand why Gemara learning. Of course, you can get the Sefer. You don't have to wait for after Pesach. Try reading the Sefer over Pesach. There's a nice English translation. It's a huge, you know, two-volume set, but I'm assuming it's Sefaria. They have some English translation. You can probably just, you know, start to read a little bit. Obviously, I'll point out some of the nuances, some of the frameworks. Mirz Hashem after Pesach. Okay? Chag Kasher v'Sameach, everyone. I mean, I'll see you the next 2 days. But. Okay? Yes.
I'm sure you'll comment later, but